Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Botchdieber podcast. Today, we are joined by Raymond Jonas, the John Bridgman Endowed Professor in History at the University of Washington. Much of Jonas's work has focused on historical topics connecting Europe, Africa, and the Americas. Today's conversation relates to Jonas's newest book, Habsburgs on the Rio Grande, The Rise and Fall of the Second Mexican Empire, made possible in part by a Botchdieber grant. During the conversation, he guides us through the brief but impactful rule of Emperor Maximilian, younger brother of Kaiser Franz Josef, and his Second Mexican Empire in the mid-19th century. My name is Luke Mogante, and I hope that you are able to connect with this unique part of history, which blends the stories of the United States, Mexico, the Habsburg dynasty, and multiple other European monarchs of the era. Enjoy! To start off, could you kind of introduce what your historical interests have been thus far, and then how the idea for your book, Habsburgs on the Rio Grande, came about?
Sure. Yes. So my name is Raymond Jonas. I'm a professor at the University of Washington, where I'm in the Department of History. And my earliest interests were in, European history, more specifically French history. But my introduction to Europe actually came earlier. I, thanks to a sister, had a job in Bavaria when I was an undergraduate. And so I lived and worked for a summer in Nördlingen. And, you know, as a part of that, I had a chance to visit other parts of Europe too. After my earlier work, I got interested in Ethiopia, the history of Ethiopia, and specifically the Battle of Adwa, which struck me as an event that both needed a history, and then ultimately one that I could do, given my training as a graduate student at Berkeley, where I did some Italian history and where I picked up a smattering of African history. My interest in the current topic, the story of the Mexican Second Empire, came about, in fact, in the aftermath of my time, my work on the Battle of Adwa. As part of that process, I started going to conferences in African studies and Ethiopian studies in order to connect with people in the field and to get a better understanding of the discipline or the sub-discipline in history and art history. And as a consequence of that, I was going to conferences in Ethiopia. In fact, Ethiopian studies meets in alternating years in Ethiopia and then somewhere else, typically in Europe or the United States. So I did a conference in Dire Dawa, and the following year we were in Vienna. And it was as a consequence of that meeting in Vienna that I had the experience that convinced me that that there was a project to be done here on the Mexican Second Empire. And that was, there was a break, and my wife and I went over to visit a neo-Gothic church on the Ringstrasse, the Votivkirche, which is in fact a neo-Gothic marvel. I've seen a lot of neo-Gothic elsewhere in Europe. You know, there's this neo-Gothic revival of the 19th century. But this is actually, very well executed. And, we were walking around and enjoying the church and looking at some of the details. And there was this glow off to one side. It was a side chapel that drew our attention. And I walked over, and we took a closer look. And it turned out that it was a shrine to the Virgin of Guadalupe. And you can imagine, my surprise. I know how that fits into the political culture of Mexico, but I wasn't expecting to see it in Vienna. And that really, intrigued me. And as I took a closer look, I understood that it was a shrine to Maximilian, and there were ex votos of various kinds organized around the shrine. And that, I don't know, dissonance, I guess, is the right word for it, that my dissonance, the dissonant reaction that I had of seeing the Virgin of Guadalupe in Vienna was, you know, what prompted me to take this on.
Yeah, that's very interesting. It's a lot of times when I have brought up the Habsburg Empire with the Habsburgs in general with people, they're surprised to find out the reach of influence or like the scope of their influence geographically over time. And a lot of people aren't even aware that they ruled over Mexico to a certain extent during any period.
That's right. As the Spanish Habsburgs, we've heard the phrase, you know, the sun in the 19th century, the sun never set on the British Empire. But in fact, an earlier instance of that remark was that the sun never set on the Habsburg Empire. And that's a reflection of the global extent of the Habsburg rule.
And your book focuses on the Second Mexican Empire. Could you kind of explain what that means and how it fits into the area contemporarily?
Yeah, so the Second Mexican Empire was an attempt on the part of Mexican conservatives and their European allies to create a monarchy for Mexico in the 1860s. It's an enterprise that really represents the convergence of a number of concerns. Among them, and primarily, is the rapid expansion of the American Republic in the 1830s and 40s. And they see, their own perception that the Mexican Republic, Mexico, you know, it's the United States of Mexico, and a clear effort to mimic the United States of America as a concept of federated states. But by the 1830s and 1840s, it's pretty clear that these sister republics in the Americas are at odds, and that in fact U.S. expansion is taking place at the expense of the Mexican Republic. And Mexican conservatives blame the Republic for this weakness. I mean, it's a convenient fact. It's not really obvious that it's the Republic per se, but they argue that that Mexico is ill-adapted to Republican institutions. So not only is the Republic weak and therefore incapable of defending Mexico and its people and its territory, but also that Mexico in its culture and its history is a country and a people better adapted to monarchical institutions. But they need allies, right? There is a civil war, the War of Reform in Mexico in the 1850s and into the 1860s. And it is a war that pits supporters of the Mexican Republic against supporters of this monarchical idea, principally the Catholic Church and the Mexican army. And the Republic turns out to be the dominant force and the winning force in this civil war. And so Mexican conservatives appeal to Europe, thinking that a European intervention can save Mexico. And they and Europe has struggled against republics in its own way, starting with the French Revolution, but also more recently in the revolutions of 1848. So there is a receptivity in Europe to this appeal for Mexican conservatives. The Mexican conservatives approach several leading ruling houses in Europe, looking for someone that they can put forward as a monarch who will rule over Mexico. And they assert as part of this that the Mexican people are not at all sympathetic to the Republic, and they would actually embrace a European monarch, if one could be provided. So the Mexican Second Empire really comes about in the context of U.S. expansion, Mexican Civil War, and then European anxieties about the rapid expansion of of the American Republic at the same time. That expansion is really upsetting Mexican, European calculations about the scale of power. The United States, by 1848, you know, extends from the East Coast out to California. And it's quite clear that the vision for the American Republic will be continental. So these various concerns, anxieties, positions converge to establish the Second Mexican Empire.
So I think one of the difficult parts of this story to follow is just all the different factions acting in their own interest from the different sides. And you've mentioned the conservatives and the Republicans, or the, I guess, liberals of Mexico at the time, and then the European powers that the Mexican conservatives appealed to. Could you kind of elaborate on who these different sides were and what their interests were in this story, in this conflict?
Yes. Yeah, so the Mexican liberals are best represented by the president of the republic, and their name that most people will know, the name of Benito Juarez. Juarez is not only a convinced liberal, a convinced supporter of Republican government, but he's a Zapotec Indian. And so he represents an interesting vision, or he in some ways embodies a vision of Mexico as a country that is pluralist in its origins. That is, there's an indigenous population that goes back to the Conquista and to Cortez, but also includes, for example, the sons and daughters, the descendants of Cortez and the conquering Spanish. And in fact, it's that those people of Creole descent, of European descent, who represent typically, quite often, but not exclusively, represent a rival vision of European rule in Mexico. Mexican conservatives are typically, in fact, overwhelmingly of European descent, typically of Spanish or Spanish-French descent. Many of them come from a noble background, and they populate the upper reaches of the Catholic Church in Mexico and the military. Their vision of Mexico is hierarchical, and they tend to be convinced that only they are the ones who can properly rule Mexico and properly defend it against its aggressors. In Europe, I mean, the empire is supported, the support for the empire includes, in fact, Mexican Creoles, that is to say, native Mexicans, who have moved to Europe for various reasons. And some of them become active lobbyists. They're in places like Rome, but also London and Paris and Madrid, and Vienna, where they lobby on behalf of two things. First of all, getting someone from one of the European ruling families to accept an invitation to become emperor of Mexico. And also, they lobby in favor of armed intervention to create this empire and to provide the military heft that will sustain it.
And who were some of the driving figures that made the decision for Europe to finally interfere and establish this empire in Mexico? I know there's the formal leaders of the different states, but you also mention interesting people like Michel Chevalier and how his notions of race and also the roles of religion within the conflict play a big role. How did these people shape the understanding of Mexico at the time and the need to interfere?
Yeah, so I think that these people like Michel Chevalier, Alexis de Tocqueville, there's no shortage of European intellectuals who are particularly concerned about the expansion of the United States, especially in the context of the Texas secession. It's important to remember that Texas, you know, in the 1820s is part of Mexico. It's a province of Mexico. And it's an area that's not particularly well populated. The Mexicans think that the way to make this part of Mexico a thriving community is to bring in settlers. And they actually, for a time, welcome Anglo settlers from the United States to come and settle on the condition, of course, that they respect Mexican law, including laws that are unfavorable to slavery. And that's really the problem for these settlers when they come in. They're particularly interested in extending the very successful plantation economy based on cotton that was thriving in Louisiana, Alabama, and Mississippi, and moving that westward into Texas. So there's almost an obvious clash. But the settlers are also supposed to respect the Catholic religion, which is seen as an important part of Mexican identity. As you know, when Tocqueville is in the United States, when others are observing what's going on in the United States, Texas is really a wake-up call for them, because they see that as these settlers pour in, they're really changing facts on the ground, that they're in a position to do what they ultimately do, which is to make Mexico essentially a settler colony that will break away from Mexico. And in fact, we know that Texas does this. And it's in the years just before that you get people like Tocqueville, people like, and then Chevalier, both of whom will in different ways talk about two key factors. One is the fact that religion is a marker of the Mexican people, but also of the Anglo-Americans who are pushing westward into Texas and beyond. And then they tend to see this also in racial terms. They see these settlers as Protestant, and they see them as Anglo-Americans or Anglo-Saxons in some other instances, and that their relationship with Mexico, which is Catholic and Latin, is a relationship that they see as profoundly antagonistic. In effect, I argue they are elaborating a kind of racial geopolitics that already by the 1820s, and this develops over the course of the 19th century, that Europeans like Chevalier, like Tocqueville, and there will be many others, Archer Gobineau, eventually Max Weber toward the end of the century, would all have brought on board ideas of race and racial expansion that inform their understanding of global geopolitics. And these collide in Texas in a spectacular fashion. And they would also drive the way Americans and Europeans and Mexicans would think about what follows the Texas secession, Texas independence, and eventually Texas, the annexation of Texas to the United States, namely the war between Mexico and the United States that worked, that, you know, results in the, from the Mexican point of view, the catastrophe of 1848, where Mexico loses half of its territory.
So in the lead up to the formation of the Second Mexican Empire, I believe in 1864, what were some major events that took place and what needed to happen or not happen for the empire to be established?
So in 1864, obviously the important background factor here is the outbreak of the American Civil War. You know, these various issues that we've been talking about, racial geopolitics, Mexican vulnerability, U.S. expansion, European alarm, they're all factors here. But what creates an opening is 1860 with, first of all, well, with the election of Abraham Lincoln and then the secession of South Carolina, followed by by secession of other Southern states. The outbreak of the American Civil War creates an opportunity that otherwise, that really potentiates the kind of European intervention in Mexico that had been discussed in the past, but didn't ever seem quite practical. With the U.S. at war with itself, with the Civil War, there's an opportunity now to intervene. The U.S. is in no position to stop European intervention. And in 1860, you know, by within just a few years, these various initiatives are coming together. In 1861, there's a convention of London signed between Spain, England, and France, which promises that they will act jointly against Mexico, which has just announced that it's going to stop making payments to European investors. It's going to default effectively on European investments. And they're going to act directly militarily, descending on Mexico, disembarking at Veracruz, and then seeking to collect on behalf of European investors. Things get complicated at that point, and they eventually part ways. But by this time, they have a candidate from one of the European ruling houses. They have Maximilian, a Habsburg Archduke. He's the younger brother of the reigning Franz Joseph of the Habsburg dynasty. And he's been looking around. He's ambitious. He's talented. He's been looking around for a place to, you know, exercise his ambition and demonstrate his talents. I should mention he's vain on top of all that. And, you know, he's not interested in Greece. He's not interested in Poland. Remember, the dominant idea in the 19th century is that peoples are ruled over by monarchs, and monarchs are trained within ruling families to rule. You know, you want to look for a proper placement for your sons, especially, and your daughters, though typically through marriage, to rule. And he's not interested in the main options at that point. He's not keen on ruling Greece. He's not sure about Poland, but he is interested in Mexico, in part because the idea of Habsburg rule and reviving the Habsburg Empire in the Americas, this appeals to his profound historic sense of his role as a Habsburg Archduke. And it also, so something about defending Mexico, defending the Latin race as he sees it or as others see it, this appeals to him too. It's not just that this is an interesting placement, you know, in terms of his ambitions, but it fits within his grand view of Habsburg resurgence. And by 1863, he's entertaining visitors who are coming. These would be Mexican expats who are living in Europe, but also high-ranking members of the Mexican Catholic Church who are coming to him. His residence at Miramare, just outside of Trieste on the Adriatic, and they're organizing a lobbying campaign, a charm offensive, if you like, in various ways, trying to convince him that he can be the redeemer of Mexico, he can be a savior of Mexico. And it's this lofty vision that really is quite seductive. Both he and his partner, his wife, Charlotte of Belgium, are really captivated by this vision that they can go to Mexico, they can save Mexico, they can defend Mexico against Yankee and Anglo aggression, and they can hold up Mexico against its enemies. This is a really powerful vision for them. And in doing so, of course, just in terms of his family politics, he can show up his brother, Franz Joseph, who's, shown that he's, you know, he has his limits as a head of state, certainly from the point of view of his brother, Maximilian. So he thinks this is a chance for him to show, to set up a contrast, an unflattering one, between Maximilian, Emperor of Mexico, and Franz Joseph, Emperor of Habsburg domains.
Yeah, I found it very interesting that the Mexican representatives that had this charm campaign, as you say, to get Maximilian to serve as monarch in Mexico alongside the French rulers, Spanish rulers, British rulers, who were also lobbying for him to take that position, that they chose an Austro-Hungarian monarch, a member of the Habsburg dynasty, for this role. Why Maximilian?
Well, you know, it's a good question. And in fact, it's not an obvious one, because they had approached a number of individuals before, hoping to find someone. One of the leading Mexican lobbyists in Europe, Gutierrez de Estrada, approached Lord Aberdeen in the 1840s. He was the Foreign Secretary of Britain, suggesting that maybe the Duke of Cambridge, Queen Victoria's cousin, would be interested in becoming Emperor of Mexico. You know, that this proposal's turned down. But he goes on then across the channel to France to talk to then reigning King Louis-Philippe, asking that maybe one of his sons would be interested. He gets turned down again. You know, he's moving, Gutierrez de Estrada is moving between Paris, London, Vienna, and Madrid, trying to find people who will accept the role, accept the throne of Mexico. He approaches a French nobleman, the Duc de Montpensier, in 1856. And then he goes after the Duc d'Aumale again, another Orleanist potential candidate. The Duke of Modena in 1860, that would be an Italian ruling family. It's not obvious that it's going to be a Habsburg. They just want a European monarch. They're convinced that only a monarch of European descent can do the job. But they're not yet convinced it's a Habsburg. I think what clicks for Maximilian is the Habsburg connection, the connection with the historical Spanish Habsburg rule. That kind of is a romantic vision that he finds he can accept, he can embrace, he can inhabit. And in fact, he and Charlotte begin to decorate their home at Miramare with frescoes that invoke the glories of the Habsburg past and try to situate themselves, Maximilian and Charlotte, in a resurgence of the Habsburg dynasty that's going to start abroad, but eventually is going to restore the Habsburgs in their global glory. I think that's the thing that's really captivating. These other candidates are interesting because they show just how persistent the Mexican expats were in trying to find a European monarch. What the Maximilian choice reveals is the power of the Habsburgs in the imagination of someone like Maximilian.
Why were the Austrians and Franz Josef not more interested in Mexico and defending the monarchy themselves when these other European powers were?
Well, I think that people like Franz Josef had plenty to be concerned about. The obvious example is Hungary. Hungarians are interested in autonomy of some form, whether within the empire or perhaps more radically as an independent state. Prussia is in the 1860s challenging Austria for leadership of the German Confederation and ultimately leadership in the effort to unify the German peoples of Europe. And of course, Prussia would ultimately prevail in war in 1866. That's a bit out there, but already, I think the concerns of Habsburg leadership in Europe at the time are much closer to home. They're just not in a position to be thinking about Mexico. But Franz Josef is willing to contemplate this role for Maximilian, in part because he realizes that Maximilian is ambitious and even dangerous. You know, he's next in line to the throne until Franz Josef and Sissi have a child who will displace Maximilian in the line of succession. But at least initially, Franz Josef is quite willing to go along with this idea, I think in part because it would get a troublesome relative out of his way, give him something to do with his time, something to do with his ambition in a place where he's not going to be a threat. A lot of this antagonism goes back to the time when Maximilian ruled in effect as a provincial governor in Lombardy and Venezia in northern Italy. And this goes back to 1857 when Maximilian rules from Milan. And he rules for not even 2 years before he's removed because Franz Josef and those around him just don't see Maximilian as the kind of person who can properly manage this very important part of the Austrian Empire. You know, there had been revolutions in Italy in 1848. They'd been successfully put down by the Austrian military. But, you know, Maximilian's politics are more liberal than the politics of people in Vienna for the most part. And there's the concerns grow. And finally, Maximilian is removed in 1859 because they just don't see him as being the right person in the role of provincial ruler in northern Italy. He's obviously very, very deeply upset about this. And I'm sure that his frustration, I'm sure his dissatisfaction with his brother, Franz Joseph, is only exacerbated by his peremptory removal from his position of power in Lombardy and Venezia. And I think it's then, in 1860, that he really begins to think about, where he can make his mark. And I think that also is something that Franz Joseph is sensitive to. Maybe Mexico is just the right place for his ambitions. I don't think he looks into it all that closely. And in fact, as it becomes more and more of a reality, more of a possibility in 1863 and 1864, Franz Joseph becomes more and more concerned about, maybe this isn't such a great idea. But at that point, it's too late. I mean, Maximilian and Charlotte have committed themselves. They've gone to Paris, where they've been royally received by Napoleon III and Empress Eugenie. Things are pretty well locked down at that point. The Habsburg leadership really finds that it's not in much of a position to manage events anymore.
And interestingly, you mentioned that Maximilian, on one hand, is doing this to redeem himself in a way in the eyes of the Habsburg family, and due to his removal from his position in northern Italy. Yeah. But he is also convinced, quite falsely, by a lot of these actors that he will be very well received by the Mexican people, and there are a lot of things he can do to liberate the Mexican people from a Mexican Republic that, in the eyes of these monarchical powers in Europe, is not beneficial to them. What are some of these reasons that Maximilian finally made the decision to take this position, and how was he misled?
Well, he's misled, but he also allows himself to be misled. One of the interesting things about his choice, he makes a provisional acceptance of the throne, but he says that it really depends on a couple of things before he's going to accept it. And there are really, I think, two conditions that stand out. One is that he wants the recognition of the British. He thinks it's important that his regime in Mexico is going to be recognized officially by the British. And the other is that he wants to see proof that the people of Mexico really do welcome him. And in both of these instances, he's going to, in fact, the evidence he gets is a little bit fuzzy, and yet he presses on. And I think what's clear is that his ambition gets the best of him, and he decides, maybe against the prevailing evidence, that he's going to go forward. First of all, it's clear that the British, before he leaves, the British recognition is not going to be forthcoming. The British don't say no, they won't, but they're really obviously very, very nervous about recognizing Maximilian as emperor of Mexico because of the possibility of antagonizing the United States. It's in some ways analogous to British reluctance to recognize the Confederate States of America and instead adopting a position of neutrality during the war. But the British say, they don't say no, but they say, well, you're going to, we need to see what the reaction is. We need to see how things go. And then when it comes to the proof of the support of the people of Mexico, there's no way to do this in any sort of organized way. Opinion polls don't exist. Holding national elections is complicated. What the supporters of the empire in Mexico do is they come up with a couple of systems. One, they form an assembly of notables who invite him to come. This is a body of some 200 Mexican leading figures in various walks of life. And then they organize these testimonials coming from towns and cities across Mexico, where there are some, typically a statement is drafted, and then figures in the community are asked to sign their names to the statement, with the statement effectively casting the allegiance of the town or the city for Maximilian and for the Mexican Empire. And lots of these are generated, and they are sent to Maximilian as part of this campaign to persuade him that, yes, there is this upswell of support from the people of Mexico for the Mexican Empire, and specifically for the rule of Maximilian and Charlotte. And, you know, they, again, the evidence, this is kind of, is how seriously should anyone take this? You know, ultimately they decide that, well, they're going to be convinced by this, they're going to be persuaded by this, that this really does show that the Mexican people overwhelmingly support the empire and overwhelmingly support their rule. There's a strong element of self-deception here, and it's worth pointing out that these testimonials from towns and cities in Mexico come, they follow the expansion of the conquest of Mexico, which is being carried out by European troops, by French troops in particular. So, you know, they march into a new town in Mexico, a new city in Mexico, and as in the aftermath of their arrival, local notables will sign on to one of these testimonials. You know, if you're not paying attention to the context in which these testimonials are being drafted and signed, you're going to miss that, you know, the obvious element of coercion may be too strong a word, but it's obvious that these are not spontaneously generated. They're only happening in the context of the expansion of authority and of a military presence that makes them possible.
And so the start of the Civil War in the United States, as the Mexican Civil War itself is winding down, the European powers see their chance to come in and take a more aggressive approach to power in Mexico. When does Maximilian first arrive in Mexico, and what does that look like?
Well, right. I mean, a couple of things are really important here. I mean, the U.S. Civil War, I mean, the attack on Fort Sumter is 1861, and the Allies, the October Convention is October of 1861. That's the Convention of London, where Spain, England, and France sign on to this intervention, and the disembarkations happen starting at the end of 1861. But the conquest of Mexico is slow. And, you know, I think in this they're deceived. The Europeans are deceived by the speed with which Winfield Scott is able to move from Veracruz to Mexico City during the U.S.-Mexican War. And they imagine something like that happening. It's a matter of weeks. But the Allies arrive, and then disagreements take place, and ultimately the Spanish and the English peel off. They decide they're not going to pursue this enterprise. The French persist, but Cinco de Mayo, 5th of May, 1862, they are stopped dead at Puebla. They never get to the capital. They have to regroup, reinforce, and they don't reach Mexico City until 1863. 1863 is obviously, that's the same year as Gettysburg, the high watermark of the Confederacy. So they're only getting to the Mexican capital just as it's, you know, from the U.S. point of view, one can begin perhaps to see the end of the Civil War, to see Union victory and Confederate defeat. And Maximilian and Charlotte are still thousands of miles away. They don't actually arrive until 1864. And by that time, you know, Atlanta has fallen. The march to the sea that will demonstrate the inability of the Confederate Army to defend the South and its population and its property is, you know, convincingly demonstrated. So, you know, by the time they arrive in the capital, the end of the Civil War is pretty clearly in sight. And here too, this obviously a powerful bit of self-deception going on, and people are hedging their bets. You know, whatever the prospects for the Mexican Empire might have been in 1861 or 1862, by the time they show up in 1864, It doesn't take a military genius to see that this is going to be the direction that the American Civil War is taking, and also the considerable challenge that the empire is going to face.
And so the British and the Spanish, who were more weary of the situation as the Civil War went on, it seems like they were hopeful of a Confederate victory. Why would this be the case?
This is a difficult point, but the Europeans looked at U.S. expansion with trepidation, with fear, because it's clear now that the American Republic, if you go back to the early Republic in the 1790s, the U.S. is really a backwater, not something that's on the radar of the Europeans once the British give up. But the Louisiana Purchase, the annexation of Texas, the annexation of Mexican territory after 1858, this really changes their calculations about the future. And they know that they have to pay attention to the United States, and that the United States is really remaking the scale of power. But there's another important factor here. The British textile industry, the French textile industry, the Belgian textile industry, they're heavily dependent upon American cotton. And so they are keenly interested in the outcome of the Civil War on a couple of levels, on an economic level, but also on a political and geopolitical level. Certainly, Confederate victory would address their geopolitical concerns, but they're not in any kind of position to openly to recognize the Confederacy. They don't want to risk their relationship with the United States in the event that the Union prevails and that the Union is preserved. So it's a very delicate situation for them. The things that they can say privately and the things that they will say publicly are evidence of this, that they're in a situation where they have to tread very carefully because they just don't know what the outcome of the Civil War will be.
And to go back to the earlier question now, at what point does Maximilian finally take up the mantle of Emperor of Mexico?
So he's he makes various indications about what he's going to do. There's some subtle clues. He starts, he hires a tutor to teach him Spanish, and he and Charlotte write letters to one another in Spanish as a way of improving their Spanish language skills. In 1864, they make a tour of European courts. They go to Paris, they go to London, they visit Queen Victoria, they go to Brussels, and then eventually to Vienna. And it's pretty clear that this is their goodbye tour. They're testing the waters and testing support as they move around. The final acceptance, it doesn't come until April. There's where a treaty is signed. There's a delegation that comes of Mexican notables, many of the people he's gotten to know because they were part of the charm offensive, trying to convince him to take on this role. This happens in April, but it's pretty clear by this time he actually has some reservations about what he's taken on. But the whole project now has such a profound momentum that he can't really pull back. And Charlotte is among those who's convinced that, this is really something that they should be doing. He has his reservations, but it's really far too late to stop at this point. And on the 14th of April, they get on board a vessel, the Novara, an Austrian naval vessel, and they begin their long voyage across the Atlantic.
And what does the Second Mexican Empire actually look like once it is established?
Well, it's a good question. And the fact is, it's never securely established. So it's an interesting problem to address. But it involves them, the imperial couple of Maximilian and Charlotte, arriving in Mexico, making their way to the capital, occupying the residence that's prepared for them at Chapultepec, and then getting started with the business of administering Mexico. they take with them all of the conventions of courtly life in Europe. And in fact, they spend the voyage from Trieste to Veracruz writing up a lengthy, hundreds of pages of courtly protocol that'll be followed. So they have an idea that they're going to create a European court in Mexico. And in fact, that's their duty, right? They're supposed to create a European monarchy there. But things are difficult. They are arriving in the middle of a civil war. The pacification of Mexico is still underway. And that's an important factor to consider. Resistance doesn't end with the conquest of Puebla in 1863. That defeat in 1862, postponed the entry into the capital. There's resistance everywhere, and the arrival of Maximilian and Charlotte, which some had argued would pacify the population. Once the Mexican people knew that their king and queen, their emperor and empress had arrived, that they would fall in line, but that turns out not to be true. The Republican leadership, President Juarez in particular, remains on Mexican soil throughout the symbolic core of Mexican resistance. There's guerrilla resistance, a kind of insurgency that is never fully pacified. The empire extends to many of the provincial capitals in the north, from Mexico City northward, but there's nothing like a moment where the empire is consolidated as a political entity. What that has consequences not just for public order, but for public revenues. The economy is constantly at the mercy of the ongoing war, the insurgency, and the war of pacification. The revenues obviously are going to suffer because of the difficult state of the economy. Moreover, most of the money that's coming in is going directly to the war effort, which means that there's not a great deal of money available for trying to establish even the appearance of normalcy in courtly life and in the capital. Charlotte does her best to go out, and she visits orphanages, she visits schools, she does all of the things that an empress is supposed to do. To show herself, to show her solicitude for the population. And Maximilian establishes an imperial bureaucracy and an imperial administration. But in the end, what happens is that, Maximilian is issuing decrees that never have any traction. The kind of bureaucratic apparatus that would reach into the cities and the towns and the villages simply doesn't exist, or exists only in fits and starts. Rule becomes a matter of profound frustration for Maximilian and Charlotte. That's what the empire looks like. And then they begin to try to find ways of shoring up support. They appeal directly to the indigenous population. Charlotte goes to the Yucatan, where they understand that they will enjoy substantial support from the indigenous population. They stage various events at Chapultepec that show their solicitude for the indigenous populations of the Americas. They reach out to the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church had been an important part of the lobbying effort to get them there, but the Catholic leadership has turned against them, they find, largely because Maximilian and Charlotte refused to undo the reforms that involved, in effect, the nationalization of church property and its sale. There were high hopes among the clergy that this property would be restored. They're not going to do that. Maximilian and Charlotte actually have a progressive vision for Mexico, and restoring Catholic lands and Catholic power is not part of that vision. But what that means is that this very important cultural force within Mexico, the Catholic Church, is now marshaled against them. So they face a situation that is, arguably from the beginning, at the very least, a very challenging situation, and arguably an impossible one.
So Maximilian and Charlotte beforehand are convinced, wrongly so, that they will have much more support from these indigenous groups and peoples beforehand than they do when they arrive. but once they're there, it seems they can continue to pursue policies that improve relations with these groups. What prevented them from getting more support from these groups as time went on? And how aware were they that some of their preconceived notions of going there were wrong after their arrival?
So the part of the issue within the indigenous population is that some parts of the indigenous population actually were victims of the reform. It was not just Catholic properties, Catholic Church properties that were taken, but all forms of collective property ownership were targeted by the reforms. And that meant that collective forms of land ownership employed by indigenous communities were also challenged and subverted by the reform laws. So, you know, if Maximilian and Charlotte were faced with a difficult problem, it's not just the Catholic Church that had been a victim of the reform laws, but some parts of the indigenous community, some indigenous communities turned against the Republic, the Mexican Republic, because the Republic had tried to convert their collective land ownership into individual private property. I mean, that was the vision of the Republic, that this land reform was going to transform land ownership and agriculture and make the Mexican economy more dynamic. But it did so at the cost of support among the indigenous. So some indigenous support for the empire is in fact not so much enthusiasm for the empire as it is enthusiasm for the empire because it opposes the Republic that had dispossessed them. So it's a complicated set of circumstances that make some indigenous communities rally to the empire. It's a little bit like, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. If the empire is against the Republic and the Republic is what dispossessed us as an indigenous community, then the empire is something that we could support.
And the guerrilla conflicts and insurgencies that you mentioned had throughout the empire continued to persist. What did these conflicts or skirmishes, I guess you could call them, look like? What would guerrillas target and how did warfare look at the time?
Well, after defeat at Puebla, there isn't much left of the Mexican army. So by the summer of 1863, there isn't really a conventional army of the Mexican Republic left. It'll have to be reassembled. But in the meantime, resistance is going to have to come from local militias, citizens' militias, that can be organized at the local level. What that effectively means is that men of fighting age will take up weapons and they will do what they can to fight the occupation and to fight the forces of the empire. And that will, you know, take the form of, you know, attacks on convoys, for example, coming from the port at Veracruz up to Puebla and from there up to the capital. I mean, if you can disrupt commerce, that's important, that's useful. And so militias would do that, insurgencies would do that. Sometimes it would come in the form of attacking European troops who were there, whether they were French or Austrian or Belgian or from elsewhere wherever they had been recruited from, but attacking these soldiers typically at moments of leisure, you know, soldiers coming out of a drinking establishment or a soldier who wanders away from base, who could be killed, you know, attacked. So resistance takes a number of forms. In some cases, the resistance, if we think about the Pacific coast, would attack in the area around Mazatlan. Again, but often this is, you know, like a classic insurgency. These are forces that come together opportunistically. They attack a particular target, whether it's a military target or a commercial economic target. But in some ways, you know, these are various ways of attacking the empire. But then when they achieve their objective, they've carried out their attack, they vanish. Right? They're civilians ultimately. And it's very easy for them then to disappear into the community, into the surrounding community of which they are a part. And what this does, of course, for the occupying forces, is this, first of all, enrages them because they've been attacked, as insurgencies do, out of the blue. And then they tend to carry out acts of reprisal because there's no conventional force for them to attack. They do what occupying armies often do, which is to lash out at the civilian population. They know the civilian population in some way is sustaining the insurgency. They know that some parts of the civilian population actually are insurgents. And so they lash out indiscriminately. The consequence of this, of course, only is to antagonize the local population, which is kind of the point of the insurgency, right? To turn the local population against the empire. And ultimately, these acts of reprisal inspire new insurgents. So it's a very successful tactic. And of course, these reprisals are counterproductive.
And at the time, Benito Juarez was still in the country, and he was still acting as a head in some ways of these pro-republic forces. And I found it interesting that at one point, Maximilian sends a message to Benito Juarez offering him the position of prime minister. Was this a way to try to mitigate these conflicts?
Yeah, so Juarez remains present as the symbolic center of resistance. There are various moments where he's nearly captured, but in the end, he escapes. You know, as it's clear that the empire is simply not being consolidated, it's not being institutionalized in any durable fashion, Maximilian tries to various things. He wants to reach out to the indigenous. He wants to reach out to the church and negotiate a concordat, which he is thwarted in doing because he's unwilling to restore Catholic properties. And then at one point, toward the end of the empire, he undertakes, two things happen. Charlotte goes back to Europe to try to rally support, notably from the French, who have now by this time decided they're going to withdraw. Meanwhile, Maximilian decides that he's going to stage a military expedition. He's actually going to leave the capital and lead his army into the field. He gets as far as Querétaro, but it seems like the intention, it's not, I mean, in military and political terms, this is always a bad idea for a head of state to put himself at the head of an army because military defeat will mean political defeat. But he's desperate at this point, and it seems that one of his ideas is that perhaps it's not clear what he imagines, a military victory, a military stalemate, but he seems to feel at some point that he can actually reach out to Juarez and persuade Juarez to join him in some sort of joint enterprise to bring peace, prosperity, and success to Mexico. Of course, Juarez is not interested in this. This is an illusion on the part of Maximilian, but gives us some insight into his state of mind. He's conjuring visions of how what looks like an increasingly desperate situation can yet result in a triumph.
What finally precipitates the fall of the empire? Or I guess, as you've explained, it's not even a fully complete empire most of the time.
Yes. So what brings about the end of the empire is this military campaign that Maximilian undertakes. He puts himself, he finally realizes that the problem with the empire is that he's relying on European troops. And so he decides that if he puts himself ahead of a truly Mexican empire, if the Europeans leave, and in particular the French forces who make up the main occupation force, if they leave, this is not a bad thing, it's a good thing. He's going to turn this to his advantage. And his supporters in Mexico tell him, the supporters of the empire tell him that if he puts himself at the head of a truly Mexican army, that will turn things around. The problem is that the forces supporting the empire now are perceived as a European force of occupation. And so he accepts this idea. He leads an army that's overwhelmingly Mexican out of the capital northward. They eventually get to the provincial capital of Querétaro, which is a city in a basin. And there they wait for a final military confrontation. That military confrontation doesn't happen. Instead, what happens is that they are surrounded in Querétaro. Mexican forces by this time renewed. There's a true Mexican army that's now created, and it surrounds the city of Querétaro. They're not going to try to take it by force. That would be very difficult. Urban combat is bloody and dangerous. So they lay siege to the city. They're going to starve it out, and they're going to force the surrender of Maximilian. And it's at Querétaro where, in effect, the empire collapses. Maximilian is captured. He is put on trial, and he is found guilty, and he and his closest associates would be executed.
One thing I read that I found really interesting is that still to this day, I don't know exactly how large this group is, but there are Mexican conservatives that will meet on an annual basis in Querétaro to celebrate the Second Mexican Empire as kind of an ideal version of Mexico. Even though the Second Mexican Empire only lasted a few short years and its influence at the time was, or power at the time within the country was relatively limited, what do you think the legacy or lasting impacts of this empire were, and how has Maximilian been viewed in retrospect?
It's an interesting question. I think that in terms of Mexican politics and Mexican history, in the book I lay out how Mexican conservatives would continue to cling to the idea that a more hierarchically organized society is what Mexico needs. And I argue that when Porfirio Diaz, who actually played a role as a young man, as a soldier in the resistance to the empire, when he becomes president in the 1880s, is clearly fascinated with the empire, fascinated with Maximilian, and adopts something of the program of the empire, at least as Maximilian elaborated it, namely that the empire is about order and progress. That ultimately is, you know, Maximilian's vision, that, you know, he's the person who can make it all work. And Porfirio Diaz, who comes to power and stays in power, he won't leave until he's toppled. But this vision of a man at the top who can make things happen remains a powerful one. And I argue in terms of 19th century Mexican politics that Porfirio Diaz sees himself as the embodiment of that vision. The other argument I make, the broader argument I make, is that the Second Mexican Empire is a really good place to get a grip on not just Mexican, but European anxieties about the geopolitical significance of the American Republic in the middle of the 19th century, and that European anxieties have everything to do with the speed, the astonishing speed of growth of the American Republic. That, I mean, look at it this way. You can take, in terms of territory, you can take France and it'll fit inside of the state of Texas. And that alone gives you an idea of how the American Republic is really changing the scale of power. And Europeans, by the end of the century, know that the future really now is really belongs to countries that are continental in scale. The United States has realized its this vision of a republic that reaches from sea to sea, from the Atlantic to the Pacific. And they're also keenly aware of the potential of Russia. Russia is backward economically, it's backward politically, but they know that the potential of Russia in terms of resources, of its demographic potential, its population, that its potential, when it's fully realized, represents a significant threat for Europe. in effect, caught between these two titans, right? These two hegemonic powers, the United States and Russia. And I think once we adopt that perspective, then we understand a little bit better, for example, 1914, Germany's bid for hegemonic power in Europe, its desire to establish itself as an alternative, as something sufficiently powerful to resist these two titans to east and to west. And so I argue that the Mexican Second Empire, you know, it's ephemeral. Maximilian is there only from 1864 until his execution in 1867. It makes it very easy to dismiss the empire as ephemeral, as foolhardy, as a fantasy. But I argue and I ask the reader to think about what the empire embodies and what motivates this people, not just Maximilian, but the thousands of volunteers who would fight to establish and to defend the empire, that the vision that exists there is a vision that reflects a real set of geopolitical concerns, and that these concerns are and also have a racial component to them. So we tend to look at the present in teleological terms. We say, of course, things had to play out this way. But if we situate ourselves in the 19th century, we recognize contingency, and we recognize and we take at face value the ideas expressed by a Tocqueville or a Chevalier or a Gutierrez de Estrada. We can see that there are real concerns, profound concerns that help us understand the world as it's taking shape, and ultimately the world that we inhabit.
Well, Ray, I must say that this topic does seem quite overwhelming at first. There's a lot of moving parts to it, but I think that you explain it in a very clear and concise way, especially throughout your book. Were there any other points to this story that you feel we didn't cover or that you want to highlight more so?
No, I think this is good. I appreciate the questions. I think the questions have brought out the salient points. So thank you.
Thank you so much for being on. I wish you the best of luck in the future, too.
Thanks. And thanks to the Bosch Cyber Institute. I mean, the support of was obviously crucial to this project, and I'm grateful for it.
Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the episode. Remember to check the episode description to find more from our guest. Follow us on social media or turn on notifications to get alerts for future episodes. The Buchdieber Institute for Austrian American Studies promotes an understanding of the historic relationship between the United States and Austria, including the lands of the former Habsburg Empire, by awarding grants and fellowships, organizing lectures and conferences, and publishing the Journal of Austrian American History. We engage with a broader public audience through digital programming, including videos, podcasts, and blog posts. Auf Wiedersehen, and see you next time.